Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. USU history professor Tammy Proctor joins us today to talk about her new book, Saving Europe, which looks at American aid and intervention in Europe between 1914 and 1924. In that crucial decade after the outbreak of World War I, Americans saw themselves in a novel role as protectors of American cultural heritage and rescuers of vulnerable populations. This book traces the development of American views of their role in the wider world, providing valuable context for later U.S. global aid and development regimes after World War II. Very timely history in the light of the recent dismantling of USAID. Tammy Proctor is a distinguished professor of history at Utah State University, co-editor of the Journal of British Studies. She's author of Female Intelligence, Women and Espionage in the First World War, Civilians in a World War, 1914-1918, and Gender and the Great War. Tammy Proctor, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
I should add another couple of titles. I think you're still interim director of the Harabi Peace Institute.
I am. It's true. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And interesting for our listeners, you're part of the team that makes Eating the Past.
That's right. Yeah.
So a lot of course, you always do a lot of stuff.
I like to keep busy.
You're an active person. Yes.
Yes.
Cycling as well, right?
Cycling too. Yes.
Cycling. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this book is quite timely. I guess it many years in the making, I read in the acknowledgments. So I guess just luck of the draw that it's so timely now that it's come out.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really imagine that when it came out in 2025, it would be, you know, that the 1920s would have returned with a vengeance. But yeah. It seems like they have. So,
yeah.
So
just to nail some of those things down, 1920s, tariffs.
Tariffs, yep.
Mm-hmm. Immigration restrictions.
Immigration restrictions, yes.
Yeah. And kind of a fluctuating view of American presence in the world, soft power, aid, that kind mm-hmm. of that's the central thing we're going to talk about here.
Yeah.
And of course, that's in the headlines right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Why did you write this book?
Well, as you said, it was many years in the making, and it might seem like a strange departure for somebody who's a European historian to be writing about American identity, but I was researching a book, the Civilians book, in Belgium. I had a Fulbright, and I was in Leuven, a little university town in Belgium, and when I arrived, we went, as one does, looking around town to see what I could see. And I stumbled across one of the main squares in town was called Herbert Hoover Square. Mm. And I thought, wow, this is weird. Why would there be a square named after Hoover in Europe? You know, this is not, you don't see a lot of Herbert Hoover streets in the United States, even though he was an American president. Next door to that square, there's a library that's known kind of colloquially as the American Library, which has all along its facade the names of universities and clubs who provided money to rebuild the library after it had been destroyed in the First World War. So I just, it was one of those things that I kind of lodged in my brain and thought, this is something I want to look into more. And so that was 20 years ago. And I've been working on the project on and off since then to sort of figure out, like, why Hoover? Why American generosity being celebrated in this way in this tiny, you know, little university town in Belgium?
Yeah. Hoover is a fascinating figure. He's kind of cast as a tragic figure at this point. Mm-hmm. But tell me a little bit more about Hoover. He's a kind of a boy wonder. And
I should mention there's a great new biography, or a couple years old now, by Kenneth White that's really a nice kind of revisitation of Hoover's life that I would recommend. But yeah, he was born in Iowa, orphaned at a young age from a Quaker family. He moved to Oregon after his parents died to live with relatives and was raised there. He was among the first graduates of Stanford University, a new university in the 19th century. He wasn't necessarily a great student, but he got a degree in geology and became a mining engineer. And really made a fortune traveling the world. He was in China during the Boxer Rebellion. He was in Australia, really part of a lot of British imperial networks for extraction of, you know, goods, lots of mining around the world. He was a wealthy man by the time he was 40, living in London in 1914, and kind of, I would say, kind of bored in 1914 when the war kind of thrust him into the public eye. And what's interesting about him, I think, is that he started with a very small bit of public service in 1914. There were a lot of Americans stranded in Europe at the outbreak of World War I. You know, they'd gone for vacation and they're stuck because a lot of the ships were being used for the war. You know, a lot of their credit was frozen. So he organized relief for these Americans. That launched him into what became a career of public service until his death, you know, four decades later.
Yeah, pretty young in this period. And
he was 40,
Even mm-hmm. not ancient when he became president, right?
And right.
And then he had the bad luck of the Depression hitting while he was president. And,
right, yeah.
And he didn't feel like the federal government really had a role in, mm-hmm. in you know, rescuing people.
Mm-hmm. I think he realized too late the need for the public intervention, that some of the things that he started putting in place, or his administration started putting in place, were things that FDR then did enact. And
right.
so, yeah.
Then he was kind of got rehabilitated later in his career. I think, you know, Thomas Dewey mm-hmm. kind of brought him back on the stage, and he became an elder statesman, you know, later mm-hmm. on. Well, let's concentrate on this period. Before we get into some of the specifics that Hoover and others did, one of the arcs in your book is America's view of their role in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So what was America's view, mm-hmm. their role in the world, kind of the start of World War I?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that America was not a major player in 1914. They were important in industrialization, in trade, especially in the Western Hemisphere. A lot of their interventions and their power was based in the Americas. And, of course, they had a growing strength in terms of naval power as well. But it's World War I that really brings them into the European and then later the global political sphere in a much bigger way. But it's not apparent in 1914 that that's going to happen. Wilson does, you know, declares neutrality at the beginning of the war. And, you know, I think it's something I always tell my students that they're surprised about. But there's a question in 1914 about which side the United mm-hmm. States would join. Nearly a quarter of the population of the U.S. had German ancestry, and German was the second language spoken in households in the U.S. in 1914. And so do they join on the side of the Germans, or do they join on the side of the British and then run into the problem of Irish sentiment about, you know, being an ally of the British? So in 1914, it's really kind of unclear.
In my mind, American involvement begins with General Pershing and the American Expeditionary Force. But in the book, you talk about how American involvement begins well before that, mm-hmm. including aid.
Yeah.
That we're talking about here.
Yeah. Well, I think one thing that we often forget about in just sort of a traditional military view of the war is that there's a lot of things that need to happen outside of the military sphere. And some of those are things that we talk about, like building and supplying munitions, or shipping troops across the ocean, you know, those sorts of issues. But the United States as a neutral power also became, in effect, the diplomatic protector of other populations. So, you know, the Berlin ambassador at the time, the U.S. ambassador to Berlin, he's taking care of all kinds of allied interests because, you know, when war broke out, all the combatants have to pull their diplomatic corps out. So if you've got people who need help, they're all going to the American ambassador or the Swiss ambassador or the Swedish. So there's this diplomatic role that the U.S. is playing immediately. They're also doing things like inspecting prisoner of war and concentration camps, being kind of a neutral eye on that. Again, like the Swiss, like the these other nations, the Dutch. But Hoover, this is where Hoover comes in. In the fall of 1914, really begins to understand that Belgium is going to be suffering a bit. They're occupied by the Germans. The line of the war goes through Belgium and northern France. And these populations that are kind of trapped are going to need food, in his view. And this is a bit of an argument. Winston Churchill doesn't want to feed the Belgians at all, because he's like, why would you feed the population that Germany's supposed to be feeding as the occupying force? But Hoover and many others around him make this kind of humanitarian argument that Belgium is a country that really exports a lot of its food, or imports a lot of its foods, and that they need resources. What follows is a massive operation to transport a lot of American goods. So this is good for the U.S. too, right? It's American farmers supplying the wheat, bringing this food into Belgium across enemy lines, and feeding the population there.
Does it's altruistic, of course, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there propaganda associated with this? That's outward facing, and I wonder how Americans were seeing this.
Yeah, it's really complicated because on the one hand, Hoover has and his colleagues have to get the agreement of both the Germans and the British and the French. You know, all sides have to agree that this food's going to come in and that it won't be used by the troops that are there, that it's only going to be for civilians. So that's one side of it. But then there's a massive propaganda and advertising machine. The United States organizes all of these local committees, mostly run by women, who are raising funds, who are donating clothing, who are getting the word out about the needs of Belgians. And some of the things that all of us are familiar with, you know, if you look at a fundraising drive today for something like UNICEF, where you see a hungry child, those feature very prominently in the First World War. And so a lot of coming together of modern propaganda, advertising, fundraising, and kind of modern business practices are part of this too.
Yeah. I do want to emphasize that it's altruistic as well, right? The cover of the book, you have small children mm-hmm. with their bowls.
Yeah. Yeah.
Outstretched. I'm not sure where this is, but it's in Europe somewhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you'd like to say about Belgium before we move on to some other countries here?
Yeah, I think that just speaking to the altruistic part of it, I think that part of the argument that this was called the Commission for Relief in Belgium that they were making, and I should say they were partnering with Belgians themselves. And in fact, most of the personnel were Belgian, organized into these committees where they were, actually cooking and distributing the food. The Americans were supervising a lot of this. And the reason that's important is that becomes a model that's then used by the post-war American Relief Administration. It's picked up by the United Nations later. If you look at the sort of partnership between the countries that are giving the aid, that are providing products, providing supervision, and the local populations, this is a model that has been sustained. And so Belgium, I guess, is sort of like the test case. It's the first time they do this in such a large scope.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's important. The other thing I want to mention about Belgium is that many of the people who are part of that effort were these young men. They were Hoover needed people quickly, so they used Rhodes Scholars from Oxford who were Americans and moved them over to Belgium. So a lot of them are 22, 23, 24. They're young, they're enthusiastic, they're idealistic, and this becomes their training ground. They populate many of the major aid organizations we associate with the middle part of the 20th century. So the first director of UNICEF, the first director of CARE, the even things like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, refugee organizations. In a sense, Belgium's the training ground.
Mm-hmm. I want to, before we get into some of the other countries, talk about that through line, right?
Yeah.
So this definitely became part of the United States' soft power.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And very consciously so, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Hoover even talked about this probably later, if we have this soft power, this aid, mm-hmm. and we're out there helping countries, that preserves peace, provides markets for our farmers,
mm-hmm.
you know, to, spreads our ideals
mm-hmm.
as well.
Yeah. I think that, there's the humanitarian argument, which a lot of these American leaders are making, that, you know, we don't stand for the starvation of children, right? That's not an American value. And they make that argument. But they're also making the argument that it is it's good politics to feed especially war-torn areas. And it's for a number of reasons. One is, as you said, markets for American goods, creating a longer-term business environment, I think, for Americans in Europe. But it's also about trying to stave off revolution, because Hoover especially felt strongly that starving people are more likely to go into the streets and overthrow a government. And they were really looking for stability as an American foreign policy goal. And that definitely features as part of this, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. This is so interesting, so timely.
Because if you don't
agree in all this, then the current actions, you know, dismantling USAID is totally fine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you happen to believe that this is an arc of history and an impulse of Americans in the world that is positive,
mm-hmm.
then you're distressed
mm-hmm.
by
yeah.
the latest developments, right?
Well, and I think that this, it should be paired also with American military power. And the opening line of the intro captures this, which is a Walter Cronkite quote in a documentary from the 60s about this aid. And he says, basically, first we crushed our enemies, and then we saved them, mm-hmm. then we fed them. And so, you know, the food aid goes hand in hand with American military aid to Europe that comes in 1917, and then with occupation, and then with creating, you know, markets and a business environment, and this idea that Americans need to be involved in the world, or it could rebound on them.
Yeah.
And that's something that seems to be a set of ideals that are in threat now.
Yeah. It's just, you know, history's a cycle, I guess,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know better than most as a historian. And I'm struck by, you know, another current resonant note, which is President Trump's announcement of tariffs.
Yeah.
Just yesterday. 1920s tariffs, right? Our own Senator Reed Smoot was big into tariffs. We're about to relive that.
And
then hopefully with not ill mm-hmm. consequences, though many have their doubts, right?
Yeah. I mean, it does feel like some mornings when I read the news that I could be reading a newspaper from the 1920s mm-hmm. because, you know, the revival of tariffs, the rejection of international organizations. So, you know, again, you think about the rejection of Wilson's plan for the League of Nations and the Versailles Treaty by the Republican Party, and, you know, of which Hoover was a member at the end of World War One. I think also the kind of nativism of the period, you know, this notion that Americans have to double down on what it means to be American and to reject foreign influence in all these different forms, you know, whether it be trade, whether it be immigration, you know, all of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, a lot of times the headlines look like they could be plucked from the 20s.
Right. I refer to it as cycles. I don't know, is it, and that implies a certain inevitability.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, as a historian, I don't know what you think. It's, you look at the past, but applying that to the future, do these things just come in cycles?
I wouldn't say inevitability. You know, there's this another notion that history rhymes, that there are, you know, themes that emerge over and over again. But they're always, I would say, in a specific context, and they're contingent. They're all. I always emphasize to students that people make decisions, and those decisions lead to consequences. But it's not like history just descends upon us. Somebody's making it. And so I would say that even though things look familiar sometimes, usually the context is quite unique.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more about the book. The book is Saving Europe. Subtitle is First World War Relief and American Identity. And the author is Tammy Proctor, who is Distinguished Professor of History at Utah State University. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with USU History Professor Tammy Proctor. She has a new book out called Saving Europe, First World War Relief and American Identity. We've been talking about all the parallels to today, right? U.S. aid abroad, immigration, tariffs. So I want to get into talking about how this all affected America's view of themselves as a power in the world and what that power should look like, right? Let's move to France.
Mm-hmm.
What did aid look like there?
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe I should just say that the book's organized around country case studies. So Belgium's the first one because that's sort of where this begins. But at the same time that Hoover is developing these programs in Belgium, you have a number of Americans and American organizations also developing programs to help civilians in France. And this was a little bit different because it's a lot of women. So where the Commission for Relief in Belgium is almost entirely men, American men, a lot of women, of course, on the Belgian side working in this. These are wealthy, often wealthy American women who are investing time and energy in trying to help French civilians. And this harkens back to, you know, this notion that France has always been a friend of the United States. You know, they think of the Lafayette Escadrille, right? The, you know, later in the war, that there's a Franco-American friendship that has to be maintained. And so some of these women start their own organizations. There's one who actually is from Kemmerer, Wyoming.
Wow.
Gertrude Thorne Kemmerer, who sets up a whole project to provide rabbits to France so that civilians can, I don't know, raise food or have pets. I don't, you know, it's basically to help French civilians in a very eccentric way. But the big organizations are started by people like Anne Morgan, J.P. Morgan's daughter, who works in devastated areas along with a lot of other volunteer women who go to France. There are Quakers there, both British and American Quakers, who help with, again, rebuilding and reconstruction in areas destroyed by the war. Even during the war, these start in 1914, near the front lines. It's, I guess, kind of a parallel organization in some ways to what's happening in Belgium, but really pretty separate in terms of their motivations and, you know, what they're trying to do.
Yeah. Let's move to rehabilitating the enemy. So Germany, for example, this is we think of the Marshall Plan after World War II, but this is an impulse in after World War I, I suppose.
Yeah, so one of the really difficult things at the end of the war is that in the former Central Powers, so this would be Germany and Austria-Hungary, there during the war there had been a blockade up on these nations that the British reinforced with its navy. And so they were really short on supplies, especially food, clothing, soap, things that were important to maintaining health and sanitary conditions. And Hoover and many other Americans in positions of power were particularly worried about children in these societies. Levels of tuberculosis were high, rickets, other kinds of diseases that were tied to malnutrition. And so there was a kind of impulse to feed these nations. But politically, this was complicated, because how do you make an argument to Americans who've just had a couple years' worth of anti-German propaganda saying that these are, you know, monsters, they're Huns? If you look at any of the propaganda of the period, they're very much dehumanized as not being like us. How do you say to them, oh, now we're going to feed them? Now we need you to be generous and to help our former enemies. So Austria becomes a little bit easier case. That's the first place that they begin to provide some food. The Quakers take the lead there, as well as an organization called Save the Children, which is still around today. Germany's a hard one. And so this is where Hoover kind of goes back to his Quaker roots, I guess. He approaches the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers in Philadelphia, and suggests that they feed Germany. They send Quaker personnel. They're, you know, most people know them as pacifists. They know them as people who have helped war victims all during the war. They've already been working in France. With the idea that Hoover will find funds, but he will funnel those funds through the Quakers. So they become kind of a front for the work that's happening. And they do so. It's not without disagreement, I'd say, among leaders, but also among just ordinary people. There's a lot of mail, you know, saying we don't think we should be feeding the Germans. The second thing that Hoover and his colleagues do in the organization's called the American Relief Administration, they approach German Americans, and they start a program where, bear with me while I explain it because it's a little complicated, where a person in the United States could go to a local bank, and Logan was part of this, so you could go to Cache Valley Bank. You bought almost like a food order. So you paid your money, $10, you got a food order. That food order you could fill out with the name of a friend or relative in another country. Then that would go to a warehouse in Germany or in Austria or in Poland, and the person would get a note saying, hey, you've got a box ready for you. And that person could then go and get the box and take it home. It's a beautiful scheme because it's personal. You could buy either for a group, so maybe you wanted to support, I don't know, like a gymnasium or something in a town that you came from. You could do that. Or you could make it an individual kind of box. Give it to your, you know, your aunt or your cousin. The boxes were made up of surplus American Army rations. So it was also a way to get rid of all of the food that they had boxed up for American soldiers that they didn't need now, that was rotting in warehouses if they didn't use them. So K rations, basically. This becomes, over time, a quite popular scheme. A lot of people who didn't have connections also bought these. So if you wanted to help people in Poland, for instance, you could buy, you know, 10 of these and send them and say, you know, distribute them as you wish. There were kosher versions of the box as well, so it's something that a lot of American Jews also use to try to support populations abroad. What I think is really interesting about this program is that it becomes the basis for the care package program that comes after World War II. In fact, some of the same personnel are involved in founding something that we all, I think most people know what a care package is. That comes from CARE, yeah, which is an organization created after World War II.
Yeah. So this is, I could see a through line here from this program to the Marshall Plan? Mm-hmm. Is it, you know, some of the same, I guess, impulses? And I guess that based on positive experience here, maybe that provided some support to them for the Marshall Plan later.
Yeah, I think there's quite a few connections, in fact. So one of the unusual things about Hoover, I'm sorry I keep bringing him up, but he pops up all over the place, is that he did a lot of important work for Democratic presidents. So Wilson appointed him U.S. Food Administrator. He appointed him, you know, to head the American Relief Administration. And then after World War II, Harry Truman asked him to lead a famine survey in Europe, you know, doing the work he had done in the 1920s, but in the 1940s. So he gathered a bunch of his old CRB, ARA guys, and they were all guys, and they did a survey of countries and created a report about where the need was. Some of that material was then used for the development of the Marshall Plan aid program. There was another Quaker feeding after World War II. So American Quakers went back again to do, you know, programs for school children. And so it really is not just a kind of echo or, you know, as we talked about before, but actually the same people being involved in these programs during and after World War II.
Let's take another break. We're talking with Tammy Proctor, who's a distinguished professor of history at Utah State University. Latest book is Saving Europe, First World War Relief and American Identity. More following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with USU history professor Tammy Proctor. And she's telling us about her new book, Saving Europe. The subtitle is First World War Relief and American Identity. Let's see if your microphone's working now.
Okay, I'm trying.
All right.
It.
Yay. Okay. Very good. So let's, you've got the chapters by country. Let's move to Poland.
Mm-hmm.
What is significant about aid to Poland?
Well, I think, again, this is an interesting story and longer than I can talk about here, but one of the things that I think is significant about Poland is that there were a lot of Polish Americans in the United States, both Catholic Polish Americans and people who were Jewish who had immigrated from Poland. And also remember, Poland wasn't a place per se, like an official country during the war. That happened in 1918. And so a lot of the post-war relief was aimed at trying to help it build itself as a nation. Poland's borders were different then, so some of the places today that are in the Ukraine, for instance, were Polish at that time. So it's sometimes good to think about it as this sort of broader area, but it was also the front lines in the war with the Soviet Union that was going on. After World War I, Poland fought with the Soviets over borders, and so the U.S. really wanted to stop Bolshevism. So they had really concrete political ideals, you know, that they wanted to pursue there. But also a lot of Americans were interested in helping Poles who were suffering. They had been under occupation by the Germans during the war, and food was scarce. There was a typhus epidemic. So a lot of reasons why they needed to be there. And so I look at two organizations, the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, which is probably the major Jewish foreign aid organization from the United States, which was founded in World War I, and the Gray Samaritans, which took Polish American young women and sent them to Poland to do aid work alongside the Quakers, the YWCA, the American Red Cross, and Hoover's organization, the ARA.
So I want to take that up right now. The kind of the through line from these organizations to, I guess, World War II to today.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these organizations, right?
Yeah. Well, I was struck when, you know, in some of the speeches that Zelensky has made about the relationship between the United States and the Ukraine, for instance, or you hear this from Polish leaders as well, the notion that the peoples have been friends for a long time, that there's been a connection between the people of Ukraine, the people of Poland, and the people of the United States. And I think a lot of that goes back to this period when Americans were donating goods, They were, you had Americans on the ground helping to distribute some of this aid. And the idea of kind of friendship across these national borders. Of course, this is true with all the countries, not just Poland. There's an expectation on the American part of gratitude. And they did get, I mean, the Library of Congress has, I don't know, maybe 7,000 letters from school children thanking Americans for goods that were sent to Woodrow Wilson. But Hoover got letters. You know, there's this outpouring of thanks, of gratitude. And I think that creeps into our modern understandings of the Americans' role in Europe, this kind of expectation of eternal gratitude. Mm-hmm. And you heard it a little bit in the interview this week with the president. You know, why aren't you more grateful? Why aren't you thanking us? And I at least think this goes back 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So another parallel.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Chapter 6, Europe, Defining and Defending Western Civilization. Very interesting. This gets into how Americans are beginning to see themselves,
mm-hmm.
and their role in the world and what they're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the book ends in 1924, which is when a lot of the American food aid programs start to wind down. Not all of them. Some of them run a little longer. But that's when, I guess you would say, fatigue sets in terms of fundraising. And, you know, people are like, hey, it's been 5 years since the end of the war. We need to move on. And so that's where I kind of marked the end. But also because it's a moment when the U.S. is redefining itself. So they're pulling back the aid. They're continuing the business connections. And some of the presence abroad is still there. But in 1924, there's an immigration act that passes that has really radical implications for who the United States is as a country. It establishes for the first time major quotas for different countries. So people who even 10 years earlier would have been able to immigrate with no problem to the United States are now subject to a quota list. So if you're from particularly Eastern Europe, this might make it difficult for you to come to the U.S. If you don't get a high quota number, then, you know, you're going to be waiting. And some of the aid people get caught up in this. I have an example in the book of a woman who was a Great Samaritan. She was a Polish-American young woman, but she had never been naturalized. So, you know, she brought here as a child, but she wasn't naturalized. She volunteers, she goes to work in Poland. When she tries to come back in 1924, she's stopped at the border because of quotas and because she's not a citizen. And there has to be intervention from high levels in order to get her back into the country. So even somebody who's doing aid for the United States gets stopped as part of this change. But also the 1924, you have some of the, you know, mid-1920s, the first citizenship acts for Native Americans. You have the creation of the Border Patrol in 1924. So lots of big political changes in trying to really say, this is who the Americans are. This is what our borders are. This is who counts as an American. And of course, it's in the midst of the rise of a new Ku Klux Klan, of Jim Crow, you know, so lots of change happening.
There's an idea that, I don't know if I'm stating this correctly, as America, of America as the keeper of Western civilization.
Yeah, yeah.
This idea was, I don't know, born here or strengthened here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whole notion of Western civilization is an American concept. It's the course as it exists in universities in the 20th century was invented here. It's not taught in European countries. And it's the idea that I think it's a justification of American intervention in Europe. So the idea is that Americans are inheriting the traditions of Europe, the things that they're saving. And this extends to actually saving materials and bringing them here. I have the example of our library's hatch room, which is filled with all kinds of things from Europe that are assembled together to make this notion of Western Civ, or you think of the cloisters, the Rockefeller Museum in New York City. But it also extended to curriculum. So, you know, one of the major Western Civilization courses was launched at Columbia University in 1919, and it spread nationwide. So, you know, in our current Utah legislature, there's debate about Western Civ. It's not something, it is something that has its own history, which I think is interesting. And so, you know, part of what is at in being debated right now is, you know, should we take this thing that was invented at the end of the First World War and reinstitute it?
We just have a couple minutes left. I wanted to talk about a piece you wrote for Oxford University Press, an essay. The title of this is "This the End of the American Century," right? Mm-hmm. We've been talking here in this book, treats the beginning of the American century,
yep.
Which was produced with, you say, moral rhetoric, internationalist sentiment, mm-hmm. the soft power, some of the other elements here, so they have Western civilization. So I guess my question is this the end of the American century right now?
Well, I'm sure that's a point of debate, but yeah, and I should say that that's a reference to an essay by Henry Luce from 1940, where he talks about the American century and what it means. I would say that some of the ideology that produced the American century in the period of World War I and after has dissipated. I think the idea that Americans have a moral obligation to improve the world is being eroded. I think the notion that Americans have something to offer in terms of leadership is changing. And certainly the idea that Americans, because of our plenty, because of our bounty, have a responsibility to share that with the world is under threat. Definitely.
Well, we'll leave it there. We're out of time. Very interesting book. It's out, Saving Europe, First World War Relief and American Identity. The author, Tammy Proctor, who's Distinguished Professor of History at Utah State University, has been with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.